From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, inside the Federal Witness Protection Program, the program that protects mobsters, white-collar criminals, drug dealers, and terrorists in return for their testimony against the people they work with. We talk with Gerald Shore, founder of the program, who ran it for 34 years and wrote most of its rules, and journalist Pete Early. They've collaborated on a new book. Also, language commentator Jeff Nunberg considers automaker strategies for naming cars. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Investigators in Georgia are combing the grounds of a crematory searching for human remains. The state's chief medical examiner says at least 130 bodies have been found so far, and there may be a lot more. The operator of the crematory has been jailed on fraud charges for allegedly charging for cremations that were never performed. United has dodged the threat of a strike that could have shut the airline down as early as tomorrow night. Union negotiators for 13,000 mechanics are recommending that members approve a new contract agreement reached with the airline today. NPR's Larry Abramson reports.
The new agreement will give mechanics a 37% pay increase that will bring the top wage to $73,000. More importantly, though, union members have won the right to vote on whether to support future wage concessions the airline might ask for. United had been demanding that mechanics automatically accept any wage givebacks that other unions at the airline accept. That has been a sticking point since United has let workers know that billions in concessions will be necessary to rescue the airline. United was in trouble before September 11th. After the attacks, revenues at United and other airlines plunged. Union members will vote on the contract proposal March 5th. Larry Abramson, NPR News, Washington.
A trial began in Houston today for the mother accused of drowning her five children in a bathtub. A lawyer for Andrea Yates says she was suffering from extreme mental illness when she drowned the children. A prosecution says she understood that she had done wrong. More violence today in the Gaza Strip and West Bank. Four Israelis and three Palestinians died in separate Palestinian attacks. Israel said it would take necessary steps to defend its citizens. NPR's Peter Kenyon reports.
Two of the attacks took place in the Gaza Strip. One Palestinian was killed while trying to get into a Jewish settlement, according to Israeli officials. In another attack, Palestinians opened fire on Israeli vehicles in the Gaza Strip, and one blew himself up. In addition to the bomber, three Israelis were killed and four wounded. Israeli tanks swung into action following the attack, shelling houses in a nearby Palestinian camp. Palestinians said four people were wounded. In the West Bank, east of Jerusalem, Israeli police stopped a car, and as the driver got out of the vehicle, he detonated a bomb by remote control. The bomber and one policeman were killed. A militant wing of Yasser Arafat's Fatah movement claimed responsibility for two of the attacks, adding to the daily death toll in the region. Peter Kenyon, NPR News, Jerusalem.
The head of the body that governs figure skating is proposing a new judging system for the sport. Otavio Cinquanta, the president of the International Skating Union, said the new judge would reduce the chances of vote swapping, which was blamed for the pairs judging scandal at the Winter Olympics. The new proposal calls for expanding the number of judges from 9 to 14, but counting the scores of only 7 of them. The judges themselves would not know whether their ratings would be counted. This is NPR News. Security personnel evacuated a terminal at New York's LaGuardia Airport this morning and recalled a passenger jet after a passenger got aboard without being properly screened. Officials say the passenger was about to get a hand search of his carry-on bag when he grabbed it and ran to catch a plane bound for Cleveland. The plane was somehow able to take off despite an alarm from the checkpoint, but it was ordered to return to the airport. Australia won its second gold medal of the Olympics today when Elisa Camplin outjumped two Canadians in aerial skiing. These are the first winter gold medals for Australia in 66 years. NPR's Howard Berkus reports from Salt Lake City.
The first Australian gold for these Olympics came when Steve Bradbury was the only skater left standing after that collision Saturday night in short track speed skating. But today, Elisa Camplin needed no mishaps to top the field in the women's aerials freestyle skiing event. It doesn't look like the United States will add to its record medal count today, but the American women's curling team advanced to the medal round by beating Norway. The men's U.S. hockey team also advanced to the sudden-death quarterfinals round with a win over Belarus. Germany won gold medals in team ski jumping and the women's biathlon relay. Tonight's the final event in the three-part ice dancing competition. And tonight, the U.S. decides who will push and break for leading U.S. women's bobsled driver Jean Racine. Brakeman Gia Johnson is nursing a hamstring injury. Howard Berkus, NPR News, Salt Lake City.
The European Union has imposed sanctions against the government of Zimbabwe after the African nation refused to allow EU observers to monitor next month's presidential election. EU officials ordered the observer team to come home. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, working with a national coalition to seek solutions for the 39 million Americans without health insurance, on the web at coveringtheuninsured.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. When the federal government tried to break up organized crime in the 60s, it was facing the code of silence and the assumption that anyone who testified would be killed. My guest Gerald Schorr figured out a way around this. In 1967, he created the Federal Witness Protection Program. In return for testimony, the federal government would keep the witness alive before, during, and after the testimony, providing him or her with a new name, identity, and home. Gerald Schorr ran the program for 34 years and wrote nearly all the program's rules. Now he's co-written a book called WITSEC, which is short for the program's official title, The Federal Witness Security Program. The book is co-authored with journalist Pete Early, who is also with us. During Schorr's tenure, the program protected 6,416 witnesses and 14,468 of their dependents. Schorr says none of the witnesses who followed the program's rules were murdered. I asked him to describe those rules.
The primary rule is to sever all contact with the people back home. That's the most difficult one for them to follow. But going out and looking for work, I mean, is a requirement. Taking a job if we find it for them, that's a requirement. But the most important rule is that they follow the security regulations that we put before them, and that is no letters going home directly. You've got to send those through a mail drop. You'd have to do that. No telephone calls directly because of caller ID. They've got to get rid of their automobile because it can be traced because of the vehicle identification number. Things like that. Things that go to security.
Pete Early, you're a journalist. Why did you want to write about the Witness Protection Program?
I think all of us have in the back of our head this kind of concept of what would it be like just to disappear, to kind of erase your past, to start over. And that is how I started and approached this book. I started interviewing people who I was lucky enough to find in the program. And then I came upon Mr. Schorr, who, of course, is the expert as far as how the program ran. I mean, this is the man who knew everyone from Joe Valachi on to Sammy Gravano, all the big mobsters, all the big players in this world. And so we decided to combine forces. I was fascinated from the aspect of how do these people actually live once they're taken out of their environment and provided with these services, but they still have that criminal mindset. That's what fascinated me.
Gerald Schorr, you were one of the founders of the Witness Protection Program. Let's go back to the beginning or even the prequel. You were involved with the Joe Valachi revelations. He was the first mafioso to break the code of silence and talk to the feds about the inner workings of the mob. What was your role in that story?
Well, Joe had been cooperating for several months with the FBI and with the fellow who was my boss, Bill Hunley, chief of the Organized Crime and Racketeering Section. And one day it was decided that a summary should be prepared of what he had to say for the President of the United States, and I was given the task of putting that summary together. While doing that, I wound up, of course, meeting with Joe. And Joe and I became fast friends after a rather disturbing beginning. And so Joe and I met rather regularly for the next couple of years until he died.
Yeah, one thing I'd like to point out is after Joe Valachi testified, the government really didn't know what to do with him. And Gerald Schorr was kind of the babysitter put in charge of him. And Gerald is the one who suggested to him that he start writing down his notes. Now, this was a guy who was nearly illiterate. And yet he turned out thousands and thousands of pages of notes. And it was Gerald then who then took this to the Justice Department and said, gee, we should get this printed. And that ended up becoming a bestseller after some controversy about whether he should be allowed to profit from publishing a book.
Gerald Schroer, when did you start to think about the need for a witness protection program? Why did you start to think about that?
I started to think about it in 1961, which is when I first joined the department under Bobby Kennedy's new expanded organized crime drive. I was assigned to work New York City, and I would fly up to New York from Washington, D.C. Several times a week. And I would begin to meet with potential witnesses, and then they would refuse to testify because, I'll be killed if I talk, kind of thing. And so I began to think about, gee, we've got to get some way for these people to survive if they testify. And then my colleagues were running into the same experience. So that one experience after another led to a need. We had to do something about it. That led to the witness program.
Peter Early, do you think the concept of the witness protection program was very controversial when it started?
It was very controversial when it first started because a lot, and it still is today, because basically the only way you can get the big fish is by getting into bed or reaching down into the gutter and getting involved with some of the little fish. Take, for example, Sammy Gravano. Here's a guy who murdered 19 people, who was a killer. And yet we needed him to go after the bigger fish, John Gotti. And so we provide him with rewards. We provide him with protection. And this is at the core is the moral issue and the dilemma that Gerald Schroer and others faced in this program.
Gerald Schroer, facing that moral dilemma, why did you feel comfortable rewarding a mobster like Sammy Gravano by giving him protection? I know you're getting to get the bigger fish that way. You're getting John Gotti that way, but still, you're giving refuge to a criminal. How were you on the ethics of that?
Well, first, I didn't always feel comfortable. Sometimes it was a very uncomfortable decision. I didn't view it as a reward. I was not in the business of granting immunity or lesser sentences or whatever. My concern was how to keep a witness alive. And so I was moving him from one part of the country to the other and helping him get started again and so that he would not again commit crime. In other words, if we left him where he was, if we didn't put him in the witness program, Sammy Gravano still would have continued his criminal behavior. John Gotti still would have continued his criminal behavior, as well as the 35 or so other people that were convicted. So by removing one, we took 35 or 6 off the street and put them in jail with the hope that Sammy Gravano would not again commit crime, which, of course, he did.
Gerald Schroer, when you were in on creating the witness protection program and you were in the position of helping to create false identities for mobsters, who did you have to talk to learn more about how to create false identities?
Well, first I contacted agencies that specialize in that business. I talked to people at the Central Intelligence Agency. I talked to people in charge of undercover operations in various federal investigative agencies. And I learned from them what techniques had to be you had to use to protect somebody, keep them alive. And I found that for the most part, their techniques were much, much greater than we really needed. We weren't keeping people away from the KGB. I didn't want to supply total false backgrounds to relocated witnesses. I was concerned they might use them to perpetrate new frauds. So we narrowed down what we were told you needed to rather basic documentation.
Like
new driver's license, but providing the person had a driver's license. I mean, we didn't give driver's licenses to people who didn't know how to drive, but we would arrange for them to get a new driver's license in a different name. We changed their names legally. We got them new birth certificates or new passports, altered their Social Security numbers so they couldn't be tracked that way. We did not give them credit histories. They didn't have real work histories. In lieu of that, I approached 200 corporations, corporate executives, and asked for their help. And they would hire people pretty much based on faith.
This is one of the core problems with the witness protection program. When you don't trust someone, you're in a weird position because you're going to reintroduce them into a community, but you really don't want to give them the financial background, et cetera, because you don't trust them because they're criminals. And what this created was all kinds of problems for witnesses. How do they get a telephone without any formal credit history? And it was particularly rough on people who happened to be innocent, a very small number, because they lost their good standing.
Now, one of the first big-time mobsters to enter the witness protection program was Vincent Fat Vinny Teresa. What did he confess to, and what did he give you that you needed in terms of testimony?
Well, Vinny was involved in the New England mob, and he was very involved in a lot of stock scams, and he was really one of the first big fish who was willing to testify about white-collar crime. One of the problems they ran into with Vinny was that he liked being famous. This not only made a problem when they relocated him, they had to move him several times because he would literally at one point jumped up on a bar and announced, hey, I'm Vinny Teresa, I'm the big mobster. But they also had trouble with Vinny because he developed what became a problem with some witnesses. He didn't want to quit. And he started inventing things and making stories up, and so he could stay in the public limelight and still be the big mafia star.
Like what? What did he make up?
He made up that he had delivered a cash payment to Meyer Lansky, one of the most famous mobsters of all time. And the government fell for it. They went down to Florida to prosecute the case. And when they got him on the stand, he couldn't describe the guy's house. And when they finally got Lansky on the stand, they showed that he was not even in the town at the time that Vinny was claiming he made this cash payoff. And so everybody got red-faced, and Vinny was abruptly moved to the marshal side of the program and then taken away and hidden. The first place they hid him was on the East Coast. They set him up in a fish market, and they had a problem because all of the other fish markets in town started having their windows broken out, etc. They went to move him, and they found out that he had sold all of the ice coolers and everything in his business, even though they were rented. And that was kind of typical of some of the problems they had with these guys.
Well, and then his problems continued after he actually entered the witness relocation program. And we moved him out west, and he got discovered there. We had to move him again, and he wanted to take his automobile with him. We told him no, so he promptly drove his automobile into the moving truck without our knowledge, concealed it with the furniture around it, after having loaded the trunk with liquor and got all that shipped to his new location. So we really got had, but we got some good results out of him eventually.
One of the problems with these early mobsters was, and Gerald just referred to it, is they'd find out they were going to be moved, and so what they'd do is they'd go out and buy everything they could on credit, and then they'd hide it, and then you'd move them, and the creditors would show up a week later and say, hey, this guy, you know, little things like, you know, $500 worth of steaks or something, and where is he? And nobody could tell him. And so that was one of the little things that they encountered.
This sounds like it was a pretty discouraging start to the witness protection program. What did you learn from this experience that you could apply to later witnesses?
We learned that we had to monitor them much closer than we thought we would in the beginning. Each witness was a learning experience. I mean, each witness brought his own set of problems. I mean, one guy we relocated from New England down to the Washington area temporarily, and he had been here 2 days before we find out that he's been arrested for being a peeping Tom. One guy went into a Sears Roebuck and stole $40 worth of, I think it was a bow and arrow, as a matter of fact, $40 bow and arrow, and he was walking down the street with it out of the store, got two or three blocks away when he was arrested, and he said he was just looking for a cashier. So we learned that we had to watch out for these folks because they were going to try to con us just as they conned everybody else.
Well, as recently as last spring, Sammy the Bull Gravano, whose testimony put John Gotti in prison, was found guilty of leading a drug ring. So this problem hasn't gone away.
Well, there are two problems. One is in the dealings with the government and as part of the relocation problem. The other is whether or not they commit crime again. And our recidivism rate is extremely low. The recidivism rate is significantly below 20%. A recent study puts it at about 10%, which means that 90% of those we relocate, of the 7,000 that are out there, are not committing crime again. So we're very pleased with that. That comes about because of the addition of more psychological help, more social worker-type help, more intense working with them, getting started in their new community.
And also, they're afraid that they're going to be killed if they're discovered. That's right. A good incentive.
Word has gone through the criminal community now, I think, that if you commit a crime while you're in the witness security program, there will be no tolerance, and you will go to prison again, and you will serve all your time.
My guests are Gerald Shore, founder of the Federal Witness Protection Program, and journalist Pete Early. They've co-authored the new book, WITSEC, Inside the Federal Witness Protection Program. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are Gerald Shore, founder of the Federal Witness Protection Program, and journalist Pete Early. They've co-authored the new book, WITSEC, Inside the Federal Witness Protection Program. Pete Early, you said at the beginning of our conversation that one of the things that interested you in writing about the Witness Protection Program was the idea of somebody going straight who had a criminal mind. What happens to that criminal mind when you're trying to live the straight life? So what are some of the insights you've learned about that from writing this book?
I think that most of the people I spoke with thought that this was going to be an easy thing to do. They'd just disappear. They'd be on the government dole for a while. They'd be famous. And what they discovered was this is probably the most horrible thing they ever encountered in their life. You have to stop and think. First of all, they're not supposed to contact any family members. They have to have their past erased. Most of us are creatures from the past, and that's how we define ourselves, who we are, how we think, how we talk. And all of a sudden, you're living a lie, which didn't really bother most of the mobsters, but it bothered them that they had to become square Johns or honest people, and it bothered them because they had lost their status and their power. Early on in the program, to hide these mobsters, they gave a lot of them rather mundane jobs, and it was pretty tough to go from having several hundred dollars in your pocket and being a big shot in New York to all of a sudden being in Rapid City, South Dakota, you know, working for a street crew. So psychologically, it was horrible for a lot of them, and then after a few years, you discovered that those who did make it adjusted rather well, and they were proud that their children had gotten out of a life of crime.
They must have really stuck out, though, particularly like you take a New York mobster who has a thick New York accent and a very kind of street type of slang, put him in a small town in the Midwest, and he's really going to stick out.
I wondered about that, and that was a problem. And then it dawned on me that I was a New York street guy who went down to the University of Texas. And I did stick out.
Yeah, but in universities tend to attract people from all over, and so you expect that at a university?
That's correct, and that's precisely the theory that I followed. Take the people out of New York, put them where there are other people from New York City or from other cities and so on, cosmopolitan areas. We did put some out there in Wyoming, and we put some out in Idaho, and those folks just did not understand the beauty of where they were living. I mean, they thought they were put out into the wilderness, and they needed the noise of the city and the excitement and so on. So we then began to move people into larger communities where they were pretty comfortable.
You'd find that these guys learned quickly how to try to work the system, and what they would do when they got stuck in Fargo was say, gee, it's dangerous out here. I just saw Pete the Hitman, and the government then would be obligated to move them, and a lot of them ended up in California or Arizona, which they much preferred. And in fact, there's a funny story. They relocated so many in Orange County, California, that they got together, and the mobsters began running into each other. They got together, and a few of them started a drug ring out there. And when the sheriff found out how many relocated mobsters were in his county, he accused the Marshal Service of relocating the entire mob right there in Orange County. And they had a one-year ban where they could not put any more mobsters in Orange County. What's funny about that is the marshal who did that did it for convenience. This was before cell phones and pagers. And he actually was putting these mobsters within driving distance of his house because they had problems and would call him up. And he didn't want to spend 4 hours driving around finding them all.
If you're just joining us, my guests are Gerald Scher, a founder of the Witness Protection Program, and journalist Pete Early. They've collaborated on the new book, WITSEC, Inside the Federal Witness Protection Program. Do you ever use plastic surgery to help create a new identity for someone who's become a witness?
I was asked about plastic surgery for one witness, and very early in the program, and I took photographs of that witness and sent them to a doctor I was told was the very best plastic surgeon in the public health service. He thought that changing a whole appearance of a face just really wasn't workable, and it was not worth the effort or the pain that the person would go through. A couple of witnesses have gone out on their own, I've been told, and have had plastic surgery, one of whom I saw his picture, and it absolutely did not change his identity at all.
Vinny Teresa weighed over 300 pounds. Gerald Scher thought, I'll change his appearance, not by plastic surgery, but by sending him to a fat farm to slim him down. He did, and as soon as the guy got out of the hospital, he stopped at a donut shop and bought a dozen donuts, had the marshal stop there, and put all the weight back on. While they haven't paid for plastic surgery, the Marshal Service has paid for breast implants to keep one mobster happy. His wife wanted them, so he got them. And in another case, a penile implant.
Oh, really?
Yeah, the mobster's self-esteem had fallen so low that a psychiatrist recommended he get a penile implant because he felt like his masculinity was suffering. And then the guy called up the marshals and he said, hey, they put this switch in here above my belly button. Every time I lean forward to eat my pasta, it goes off. What do I do? It's embarrassing. And the marshal very smartly said, well, get a lower table or a higher chair.
That's great. But I guess that implant isn't going to help you change your identity when you're in the supermarket.
No, it doesn't change your identity. It might change your reputation.
That's
but
right.
The idea was he was so devastated by testifying against his former buddies that he just thought he was less of a man, and actually his wife and his girlfriend were thinking about leaving him.
Gerald Scher is the founder of the Federal Witness Protection Program. Pete Early is a journalist. Their new book is called WITSEC, Inside the Federal Witness Protection Program. They'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by Delta Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House. Publisher of Mary and O'Neill, a novel and stories by Justin Cronin, available in paperback, and the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, relocating federal witnesses, as well as their wives and mistresses. We continue our discussion with Gerald Scher, founder of the Federal Witness Protection Program, and journalist Pete Early. Also, language commentator Jeff Nunberg considers how cars are named. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're talking about the Federal Witness Protection Program with its founder, Gerald Shore, who also ran the program for 34 years. Also with us is Washington Post reporter Pete Early. They've co-authored a book called WITSEC, Inside the Federal Witness Protection Program. The program has given mobsters, white-collar criminals, drug dealers, and terrorists new names, identities, and homes to protect them in return for testimony that can help convict others. When a mobster joined the witness protection program, how much of a choice did they have over who they took with them, their wife, their kids, their mistress? I mean, who could they bring into this new identity with them?
What I looked for was who was in danger as a result of this person's testimony. And I would watch out for who they left behind. For example, I had one fellow who wanted to relocate his mistress but not his wife. And she certainly would have been in danger. And what he was looking for was us to become a quick vehicle to an end to the marriage. We relocated the wife, of course, as well.
So you relocated the wife and the mistress?
That's correct. Right. To different places.
Oh.
Now, there were some occasions, on some occasions, we've relocated the wife and mistress to the same community. And in one particular case, the mistress moved in with the fellow's parents, who we relocated. And his wife lived with him, she knowing about the mistress. So we felt it was not for us to judge the relationships among the people, but to make sure that those who might have been killed because that witness testified were kept safe.
You know, these people brought a lot of baggage with them. Most of them were very dysfunctional. So what Jerry Shore had to deal with was not only relocating them, but, for instance, a mobster and his wife would be in the program. They decide to get divorced. You had to relocate each of them and not let the other know where they were going because you didn't want the wife saying, well, I'm going to get even and turn him in. Then you had situations where the mobster would take his girlfriend and her children with him, and the ex-husband would all of a sudden discover, hey, my kids have disappeared. Where are they? And Gerald sure had to deal with that.
Have there been witnesses who have had their covers blown?
There have been witnesses who've had their covers blown where they themselves have taken an action to cause that to happen. None of the witnesses who have followed the rules that we've laid down have been found and killed. Some have gone back home. Some decided to deal in crime in their local community, like Sammy Gravano. Some of those have been found. One fellow went back home, opened up the door of his house, and it blew up in his hand and blew him up. He, of course, had been told not to go home. The program in over the 30 years has been extraordinarily successful as far as keeping witnesses alive.
I think it was more that these guys tended to blow their own covers. I mean, you had one who was a relocated witness who decided to run to be mayor of his city. That's a little tough. Another one got angry at the program, didn't feel like he was being treated properly, so he made two big signs he hung around his neck that said mob star and a big target and protested out in front of the federal building.
The fellow who ran for mayor of the city advertised during his campaign that he was very skillful in dealing with city crime because he himself had been a criminal.
And what did he also say? He said something like, you'll know, I'm telling you up front that I'm going to steal the money or something like
similar to that, right.
So I steal it, you know I'm going to steal it before I'm elected.
Not typical, I should say.
I'm sure that the mob wanted to find people who had ratted on them and wanted to infiltrate the witness protection program. Gerald Shore, did you ever feel like you were in jeopardy that maybe the mob would be after you and torture you until you gave them information about witnesses against them who were now using fake IDs?
I had a few instances occur. One time I had one of the witnesses in my office who looked at a picture of my wife and said, how would you feel if she turned up missing? One day we had a phone call at home, and my daughter answered the phone, and someone said, have you ever thought about death? Those we knew who was doing that, and we could sort of make those go away. The more serious one was about 10 years ago when I was advised that the Colombian narcotics cartel had hired someone to kidnap me or my wife. The intent being to get the information about where a relocated witness was hiding. What they didn't know, of course, was that I don't know where witnesses are hiding. We built that into the system, so I wouldn't know. So there I was with that combination of a threat of being tortured and not having the information to give up. So my wife and I wound up going into the witness protection program.
And how long were you in the program?
Well, we were in the program for several weeks, a few months, actually. My wife was a school teacher, and she had insisted that she continue to teach her class. She was a first, second grade teacher, and she thought those kids really needed her, which I guess they did. And so the Marshal Service assigned an undercover marshal to work with her. And the people at school, the other teachers, did not know that she had an undercover marshal. The only one who did know was the principal. And there was no danger to the children. The assessment indicated that the threat to her was moving to and from work, not at work. I continued to work, and I had, at that time, had marshals only follow me out of the Justice Department to make sure that I wasn't being tailed. And after 10 or 15, 20 minutes of driving, they would call me on my cell phone, tell me it's clear. And then I would drive another hour out of the way to make sure. And then I would proceed on to wherever we were living at that time. We moved from hotel to hotel in the Washington area.
What did you learn about what you put witnesses in the Witness Protection Act through by going through it yourself?
I was putting them through a very, very uncomfortable experience. And even the remembering part was difficult. The first night that I was to meet my wife after I got this information was at a hotel in Baltimore. She had been taken from school directly to this hotel and told that after a secret knock on the door, she could open the door. I got in there, and I had been given checked in under a new name. I wanted to leave a wake-up call. And just simply dialed the operator and said, I'd like a wake-up call for, 7 o'clock in the morning. And she says, yes, and your name, please? And I couldn't remember my name, what my new name was.
Right.
And never before had I been asked for my name when I asked for a wake-up call. Usually I just announced the room number. And so I went, and leaned to Miriam and said, what's my name? And she said, Parker. And I said, Parker. And so I realized that was a problem. I'm accustomed to, as is my wife, looking into the rearview mirror. That was not new to us. She learned a long time before that whenever she drove, she was to see whether or not cars were following her, and if they were, she knew what to do, driving in and out of shopping centers, police stations, that sort of thing. Running into people. I used to have witnesses tell me that they ran into people that they knew. My wife and I went grocery shopping 50 miles from where we should be grocery shopping. And we fill up a basket full of groceries, and there is my wife's first cousin coming in the store, at which time we decided we better get the hell out of here and left the groceries to melt or whatever they do, and we snuck out of the store. We did not want to have to explain where we were and why we were there. I had to sneak into my granddaughter's graduation from high school. The family did not know what our problem was. We couldn't tell them the matter was being investigated. So I snuck into her graduation, told her I would be late, that I couldn't go with the rest of the family because I'd be working. Father's Day, normally the family would be together. I told them I had to work, but we could meet and have a picnic inside the Justice Department where I knew it would be safe. And I arrived an hour before them. I left an hour and a half after them. So I began to realize the discomfort that the witnesses were going through, something I thought about but never quite experienced. Let me interject here, by the way, something totally unrelated. We've not mentioned the witness protection and the Bureau of Prisons, and they hide about half the witnesses.
Tell us about them.
Okay. Half the witnesses that enter the program today are hidden in witness protection units by the Federal Bureau of Prisons. This started several years back when witnesses that were going to testify had been convicted of crimes, had time to serve, and we couldn't put them in general population. But obviously, they would be murdered for being witnesses. So with the help of Norm Carlson, the director of the Federal Bureau of Prisons, we developed a witness security unit in New York City, which was on the third floor of a high-rise, in effect, jail as opposed to prison. And in that unit, we began to put one witness after another until we finally had 50 or 60 witnesses hidden in this one place and realized this isn't workable. We need to get more units. And as a result, Bureau of Prisons developed several prison units throughout their system, each holding 60 to 70 cooperating inmates. What's fascinating about them is that these are inmates that oftentimes would have killed each other in a regular prison system because they generally hated each other. You had gangs that competed with each other. You had witnesses who testified against one another, all in the same place. And yet it was really very peaceful in those units because they had one thing in common, staying alive. And they knew that if they did something wrong in the unit, they could get sent to general population.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about the Federal Witness Protection Program. My guests are Gerald Scher, who founded and ran the Federal Witness Protection Program. He ran it for about 30 years. And journalist Pete Early. They've collaborated on the new book, WITSEC, Inside the Federal Witness Protection Program. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are Gerald Scher, founder of the Federal Witness Protection Program, and journalist Pete Early. They've co-authored the new book, WITSEC, Inside the Federal Witness Protection Program. Now, Gerald Scher, you worked with some of the international terrorists involved with the 1993 World Trade Center bombing and the thwarted plot to blow up New York landmarks. What are some of the differences working with international terrorists compared to New York mobsters?
Well, I started to say cultural differences, but as you pointed out earlier, there's some cultural differences between New Yorkers and the rest of the United States in some ways. But cultural differences with respect to their religion, to their customs, to their dress made it somewhat difficult. Even within the families, there was a problem. I recall one instance where the fellow's, the witness's wife, wanted to go to college, and she wanted to absorb some of our Western culture. And her husband wanted her to maintain the traditional dress, the traditional attitude. He didn't want her to go to college. He didn't want her to get a job, all of the things that she wanted to do. And that required really considerable counseling on both parts. People coming from the Mideast wish to be relocated to areas where they can practice their religion, where there were mosques. That was fairly easy to put people where there were mosques, but you had to be concerned about would other people who attended religious services with them begin to pick out who they were. We found out it was workable. It can be done, primarily because this is such a very, very large country, and we have so much choice in where we can place people. My European counterparts often would express envy over the fact that we had 3,000 miles across the country, whereas in the Netherlands it was significantly worse and other countries in Europe.
Could you be confident that the Islamic extremists who you gave new identities because they had confessed to their involvement in conspiracies, could you be confident that they weren't still part of terrorist networks?
Well, confident and guarantees are words that are difficult words to deal with. Well, certainly we couldn't guarantee that any more than we could guarantee that a relocated criminal won't commit crime again. I think the information supplied by the intelligence agencies to us about those individuals would probably be the best guide as to whether or not those people would again be involved in terrorist activities. I was very comfortable with the people we relocated in the first World Trade Center case.
And are they still living as relocated witnesses in the protection program?
Yes, but that implies that you're always receiving benefits or something from the program, and you're always tied to it. After you're safe and after you've established your own new life, then there is no activity between the government and that witness unless that witness is again endangered as a result of their testimony.
I want to read a really interesting quote that is from the head of the Federal Marshal Service that ran the protection for the witnesses in the Witness Protection Program. And he said, "If you take the government's dollar to protect a witness, you have to be prepared to take the bullet, whether it's for a scumbag or the President of the United States. You don't take a bullet for the mafioso. You take it because you're a professional." Any reactions to that?
Yeah, that's the statement of a remarkable guy, Reese Cash, who was the first guy to head the program for the Marshal Service. And he came in under the most difficult times, no support in the terms of money or manpower and so on. And he had received a complaint from one of his people who said, "Look, I don't want to hang around with these creeps, these dirty guys and so on." And he was simply saying, "Look, you're getting paid to do a job, and your own personal feelings have to be put aside, and I expect you to do that job." And interestingly enough, he himself did not particularly like this program, and yet did a remarkable job in trying to get it off the ground.
I think that that is the key to why the program worked initially. Inside the Marshal Service, there was a lot of problems with this because marshals initially didn't like protecting these people, and they had to develop specialists. And then the problem sure faced was keeping these specialists from becoming advocates for the people they were protecting.
Gerald Schur, did you ever run into a similar problem in the sense of thinking, like, I really don't like these guys, I really don't want to be in the position of protecting them, but I have to, and I'm a professional, and I know it's somehow for the larger good?
Well, you've hit it. I mean, you hit it right on the head. I'm a goal-oriented person. And my object was to see to it that the courts, that our system of justice could work. And it can't work if witnesses are intimidated. And so that was what drove me to working with this program. I knew that if we could get witnesses protected, they could testify. If they testify, the system works. I did not always like these people, as I indicated earlier. And sometimes I should confess, I mean, I made a mistake. I mean, I put in people into the witness program that probably should have been a defendant, and I should have had the defendants used as a witness. That wasn't always my choice, but there were times I reflected back and said, nope, that was wrong.
Gerald Schur, just one more question for you. You mentioned in the book that you have multiple sclerosis, and that could be very painful. When it flares up, you've had very painful episodes. Has it been possible to distract yourself from the pain so that you can continue what's already pretty complicated, problematic work?
Well, curiously, I found that the worse I felt, the worse the attack, the more I wanted to get to work, because getting to work and dealing with some of these characters was extremely distracting. And so I think that a lot of people at work never really knew that I had multiple sclerosis. But I've been fortunate. I have a case that allows me to go to work. There are those who are less fortunate that can't do that. So I found multiple sclerosis an inconvenience, sometimes annoying, but really it drove me to go to work.
I want to thank you both so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Gerald Schur created the Federal Witness Protection Program. Pete Early is a journalist. Their new book is called WITSEC, Inside the Federal Witness Protection Program. Coming up, language commentator Jeff Nunberg on automaker strategies for naming cars. This is Fresh Air. We'll be right back. Retro is very big among the Detroit car makers these days, as you can see by the design of cars like the PT Cruiser and the Plymouth Prowler. But as our linguist Jeff Nunberg points out, the nostalgia extends to old-fashioned car names as well.
2 years ago, General Motors successfully revived the Impala name for its full-size Chevrolets, and last month at the Detroit Auto Show, the company debuted a new concept convertible that bears the name of the old Chevy Bel Air. But it's one thing to revive a name and another to revive its precise connotations. As the linguist Mark Aronoff has pointed out, the big three model names of the 1950s and 60s really acquired their meanings from their place in a vast and slowly turning wheel of brands. Recall how things were back then, when every American make of car had several distinct models for each of its lines, full-sized, mid-sized, and compact. In 1958, there were three full-size Chevrolet models, the Deluxe Bel Air, the Standard Biscayne, and the Economy Del Rey. The Impala was introduced in that year as a special edition of the Bel Air. Then the next year, the Impala became a separate model of its own, and the other models were demoted. The Bel Air became the standard model, the Biscayne became the new economy model, and the old economy Del Rey was dropped. The same process was repeated a few years later when Chevy introduced a new deluxe model called the Caprice and demoted the Impala and Bel Air a notch, eliminating the Biscayne name at the bottom. The cycle was the same at Chrysler and Ford. The Fairlane, the Galaxy, the LTD, each of them started out as a limited edition deluxe model, then worked its way gradually down the chain to the economy slot. While it lasted, it was the most elaborate and successful experiment ever undertaken in the semantic manipulation of demand. Every few years, a new name was introduced, fastened to a rare and desirable object, and then over time, the cars it was attached to were made cheaper and more accessible to the point where anyone could have one. But it was also probably the most wasteful marketing strategy ever developed. Companies deliberately degraded their established brand names just to increase the demand for new ones, like a builder who lets an apartment complex go to seed so that tenants will want to move into the new one he's putting up next door. What was remarkable was that consumers were willing to buy into the illusions that the system rested on. In fact, there was virtually no difference between the models, apart from the options and trim. The main feature that distinguished the deluxe Chevy models from the standard and economy models was that they had three little round taillights on each side rather than two. But the great wheel of model names could only keep turning so long as the car companies could assume that consumers had nowhere else to go, that people would be willing to spend their entire lives climbing the ladder of GM brands even as the company kept throwing more grease on the rungs. And by the 1970s, consumers were becoming less willing to replace their cars every few years just so they could own the new model, partly because new car prices were rising much more rapidly than the average family income, and partly because the Japanese and Europeans were grabbing large parts of the U.S. market with brand names that kept their luster over the long haul. By the 80s, American car makers were offering only one model per line. All of that led to changes in the kinds of names that manufacturers were putting on their models. The car names of the 50s and 60s were based on a few unimaginative patterns. Most were taken from the names of exotic destinations like the Monte Carlo and the Seville, from animals like the Mustang and Impala, or from vaguely superlative words like the Regal and the Invicta. But then those names didn't have to be evocative. Their connotations were inherited from their place in the constellation of brands and shifted as they moved from deluxe to standard to economy. It was only when the system broke down in the late 70s that car marketers took to using fanciful names in the fond hope they would connote the car's character all by themselves. That's when they began appropriating random English words or jumbles of nonsense syllables, as car names started to sound like the names of every other product. A Monte Carlo or Mustang could only be a car. But Prodigy, Protege, Prism, Precy, Prius, those could as easily be digital cameras or office productivity software. And other names sounded like they should be attached to China patterns or cosmetic lines. Corando, Elantra, Vitara, Sedona, Nubira. They're words out of some lingua branda of the far future, what we'll all speak when the last common noun has been trademarked. Among the big three, names like those started to become nervous incantations, as if the car makers believed the right string of syllables could somehow conjure a market niche out of nowhere. Long before General Motors announced this year that they were phasing out the Oldsmobile brand, you could tell the division was in trouble just from the desperation of its model names in the late 90s. Alero, Achieva, Bravada, Sierra with a C. It was a sad dotage for the brand that gave Americans classic model names like the Rocket 88, the Futuramic 98, the Starfire, and the Toronado. Of course, there's always the possibility that GM will someday bring back the names of some of those vintage Oldsmobiles, particularly if the nostalgia vogue continues. But I think it's safe to say we've heard the last of Alero.
Jeff Nunberg is a consulting linguist at Stanford University and the author of the new book, The Way We Talk Now. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Megan Hal, Patty Leswing, and Jessica Chu. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. I'm Terry Gross. We'll close with a track from guitarist Borelli LeGren's new CD, Gypsy Project. This is a Django Reinhardt composition called Daphne.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Vintage Books, publishers of the new paperback Founding Brothers, The Revolutionary Generation by Joseph J. Ellis. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
I'm sorry, so sorry.
I'm Sorry was singer Brenda Lee's first number one hit, recorded when she was just 15 years old. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Brenda Lee. This year, she'll be inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.